Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Theology in the Raw. Okay, this episode is going to be, it's going to be controversial. I mean, this is Theology in the Raw, and almost every episode is controversial, I think. But this one is particularly sensitive. Let me just give you a brief backstory on how I got in touch with Dr. Julie Maxwell. First of all, she's a pediatrician in the United Kingdom and has been in the last several years has been fairly involved with the gender conversation, specifically as a pediatrician, how to best treat or think through teens and children with gender dysphoria. And she has written articles on this topic and has kind of just entered into a very controversial area. So Julie read my book and really loved it. She reached out with an email saying, "Hey, I loved your book, Embodied. I do have a slightly different perspective on your position on pronouns, like using someone's pronouns, or as some people say, using someone's preferred pronouns." Okay, so let me just first of all share just as concisely as I can kind of my perspective on pronouns. I often get asked, you know, should a Christian use a person's preferred pronouns? Now, I just want to acknowledge some people don't like the term preferred pronouns. Some people say just call them your pronouns or their pronouns. And so I've thought through this question for quite a bit of time. And a good chunk of my chapter in my book Embodied deals with whether Christians should use someone's pronouns if they don't match their biological sex. Okay, so if a male wants you to call them she or her, or maybe they them, you know, is another part of this conversation. You know, should a Christian comply to that? Now, some people would say that it's lying to use the pronouns of a person that doesn't match their biological sex. Other people would say, like, I don't want to, and this is, I'm going to quote somebody here, you know, I don't want to feed their delusion. I think that language is a bit strong and can be pretty dehumanizing. But that would be an argument too. Like, if somebody thinks they are, or if somebody is a male and thinks they're female, or a female and thinks they're male, or identifies as a sex different than who they actually are, that they are deluding themselves. And if I use their pronouns, then I'm only furthering that delusion. Okay, so that would be one perspective, that we need to be truth tellers, that we need to not encourage somebody's wrong view of themselves. Another perspective is what I call, or what Greg Coles calls, pronoun hospitality. And this is a view that I do take. And I've talked about this in the podcast before, so I know this is probably a bit old news to some of you who have been listening for a while. But pronoun hospitality says that you don't necessarily need to agree with a person's use of their pronouns, but as people who want to meet someone where they're at, we should exercise hospitality and use the pronouns that they desire that you would use of them, okay? And the way I've explained it is that language is shared social space, right? Shared social space. So if you're watching on the video version of this podcast, which you can go to YouTube, and it usually the video version is released after the audio version, but for those of you watching, so language is shared social space. I'm doing some arm signals here. Over here, you have person A, and person A has a certain worldview. And over here, you have person B, and person B has another certain worldview. And the way they relate to each other is through this common ground of language. Language is shared social space. Now, sometimes as person A and person B are trying to talk, there's worldview differences that affect how they use certain words. And so person A might believe that pronouns are supposed to match a person's biological sex, whereas person B might think, no, pronouns match my gender identity, not my biological sex. Person A can say, well, I don't even agree with that whole perspective. I don't even think gender identity is a thing. Somebody could, you know, person A might have that worldview. But for person B, it is a thing. It's a huge part of their life, and pronouns can be a big part of that, of their journey. And so somebody kind of has to give in. And this is where I'm going to say, as a Christian, I think that Christians should use the person's pronouns as a way of meeting them where they're at, as a way of using this. Because if we demand that person B lines up with our worldview commitments and uses language in the same exact way that we understand language, because again, language is connected to someone's worldview, then we're going to have a hard time relating with people. And specifically within the trans conversation, pronouns oftentimes are a huge deal to trans-identified people. When I say trans-identified, I'm including non-binary, people who identify as gender fluid, gender queer, and so on. Even if you don't understand that, even if you get frustrated at the whole pronoun thing, for other people, this is a huge deal. And for some people, hearing pronouns that match their biological sex can exacerbate their dysphoria. And it could possibly even lead to thoughts of self-harm, maybe even suicidal ideation, and so on. So as a way of meeting someone where they're at, I think in the chapter in my book and in other places, I encourage people to use a trans-identified person's pronouns, okay? Even if you don't necessarily agree that pronouns should match gender identity and not biological sex. So that's my general position. Now, over the last couple of years, I have talked to several counselors, psychologists. I'm thinking right now of one medical doctor, one counselor, another medical doctor, a parent, a couple detransitioners, people who used to identify as trans and now no longer do. All of these people, I'm not going to name names, but I've got their names in my head, have said to me, basically, Preston, I see your general point, and I might even agree with it, but when it comes to parents and children, we would recommend not using your child's pronouns, okay? And I've tried to think through this perspective, because these are people that I are very, you know, gracious and wise and are working a lot with young trans-identified kids, okay, so like pre-adolescent or even adolescent kids, and they have said there are certain cases where we don't think it's helpful or good for the kid, for the parent especially, to use the person's pronouns. Obviously, the parent should be obvious. Obviously, the parent should be loving and listening and create a nurturing environment, and should walk with the child and listen to the child and cry with the child and rejoice with the child and be there for them, provide a loving, safe context. But in certain situations, that doesn't necessarily, this is their perspective, that doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with every demand of the child. And this might be a case where it's more helpful for the long-term well-being of the child to not, as they would say, give in to pronoun usage, which might reflect some degree of social transitioning. So Julie is of that persuasion as well. So she reached out to me recently and said, I loved your book, agree with so much of it. I like your general take on pronouns, but I think there's cases, especially with younger teens that might be wrestling with lots of other mental health issues. Maybe they fall within the rapid onset gender dysphoria kind of category. Maybe they're really young, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And she says, I've got several scenarios where it was actually unhelpful for the parent to use a child's pronoun. So I said, you know what, Julie, thank you for reaching out. Can we talk about this in the podcast? And so we were going to have a phone conversation, but I'm like, let's just have a live podcast conversation, because this is Theology in the Raw and this is Extra Raw. So we're, in a sense, we just had a conversation. I said, I want to hear your perspective, because I keep hearing people I respect share this as kind of one caveat, one scenario where not using a young person's pronouns might be the most helpful for that person. And so again, this isn't kind of this stubborn resistance of this anti-trans, you know, I don't like trans people, so I'm not going to use their pronouns, or this is a Marxist agenda of trying to take over the country, and so I'm just going to resist it. Or it's not coming from that kind of spirit. And that's why I wanted to have Julie and maybe not some other people on to talk about a kind of slightly different perspective. And so we had a conversation about it. And for some of you, I think you'll probably just full on agree with her. Some of you are parents who are like, man, this is exactly my situation, and I'd agree with Julie. Some of you might say, I totally disagree with Julie. And some of you might even say, I can't believe you're even having her on, you know, the whole, like, you're platforming this, you know, harmful, dangerous perspective or whatever. I don't take that approach. Like, I think if somebody has good, thoughtful things to say, we should consider it. We should wrestle with it. And I thought, flat out, Dr. Julie Maxwell had good, thoughtful, convincing things to say. And so I'm still wrestling with it personally. I think she brought up some really good points, and I'm going to let her share those points with us. So we focus on the pronoun discussion for the first part, and then we do get into some broader conversations about kind of where is the medical community at, especially in the UK and continental Europe? Where is the medical community at in terms of addressing teens who identify as trans, who might be experiencing gender dysphoria? It's a huge debate today. Lots of kind of upheaval going on in the UK and in Europe. United States, not so much. We're still kind of behind the times a little bit in terms of some apparent kind of, like, on the surface medical consensus, which isn't really accurate. But yeah, so I think it's helpful for us to kind of look at the UK and other countries that are kind of further along than we are in this conversation, to kind of learn from maybe some mistakes that they've made. And we talk about that quite a bit in this podcast. So that's a long intro, I know, but I want to kind of set it up with kind of my approach to how I've wrestled with the pronoun debate, and also why I wanted to wrestle with Julie's really thoughtful perspective. So if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/TheologyInTheRaw, support the show for as little as $5 a month, and become part of the Theology in the Raw community. All of the info is in the show notes. Really appreciate your support of this show. Without further ado, let's get to know the one and only Dr. Julie Maxwell. All right. Hey, friends. I'm here with somebody who I've known from a distance. I've seen your name pop up in some articles and stuff that I've come across. And I was so excited, Julie, when you reached out to me. So thanks so much for being on Theology in the Raw. I know this is kind of a last minute setup. We've had some email exchanges, and I was like, man, well, let's just get on the podcast and talk about this. And yeah, as I said in the intro, I mean, everything we're going to be talking about now is going to be debated, controversial. Some of our listeners might, you know, applaud some things we say at one point and then be, you know, cursing and screaming the next point. So this is Theology in the Raw. We want to have open, honest conversations, and even especially with sensitive topics like the one we're going to talk about. So Julie, yeah, I want to, I already shared my perspective on the pronoun conversation. Why don't we jump in? Let's just back up. Why don't you tell people who you are, what you do, and then we'd love to dive into the pronoun conversation.
Yeah, hi. I'm Julie, and I'm in the UK. I'm a community pediatrician, which means that I work with children with learning difficulties, autism, ADHD, language disorders. I also work for an organisation called Lovewise, which teaches Christian sex education. So that's partly how I kind of got interested in the whole gender area. Got three of my own children. I was going to say three teenagers, but one's 20, so she's not a teenager anymore. And I also head up the 11 to 14s youth work in my local church as well.
And you're in southeast London, you said, or southwest?
Southwest of London, yeah.
Okay. Okay, by the airport, or one of the many airports? Well,
about an hour from London.
Okay. London was one of my favorite cities. I've only been there a couple of times, but driving in London was I don't recommend that for Americans.
No, nor UK people either. I only ever go by train, but I'm missing it. I haven't been to London in about a year now. I'm going on Friday, actually.
Okay. Why don't you start? Can you summarize your general perspective on the pronoun kind of discussion, where you've come from? And then I want to dive down specifically into your specific field as a pediatrician and using pronouns with younger children, because I know that is kind of a unique situation.
Yeah, so I mean, I think as I've got interested in the whole gender issue and kind of started off just, I suppose it was a bit of an academic interest to start with. I started reading about it. I then discovered I had a friend who had a teenage son who was identifying as a girl. And then I've increasingly read lots of things, but also gradually got to know families who've got children identifying as the opposite sex, both informally and through work. So I suppose I started off with a very clear kind of, well, I would never use the incorrect, biologically incorrect pronouns in any circumstance because it would be dishonest. However, you know, I sort of think, you know, it, when I'm faced with a, for example, a 16-year-old who turns up in my clinic, I'm, you know, to that 16-year-old who is a already very troubled young person, you know, I'm not going to do anything that is going to upset them or make them, you know, make them feel uncomfortable. However, I'm going to be honest with them. So, you know, so I think it's one of those things that is a little bit dependent on each individual situation. You know, if and you might be in a situation where you don't know. So if somebody appears to you and says that they're a boy, it might only be later that you find out that actually biologically they're a girl or vice versa. But I think what really concerns me is this whole area of sort of social transition. So when you're talking about children, and I mean, I've come across children as young as 5 or 6 who are socially transitioned. And the whole name and pronoun thing is a really big issue for them. So that for them is the sort of big thing that is then often, I mean, I don't know how it works in the US, but in the UK, schools will have celebration assemblies where they'll kind of reintroduce this child with this new name and this new pronoun, and everybody has to call the child by the new name and the new pronoun. And this child then is then led into a situation where they believe that everybody really believes that they're the opposite sex. So particularly for a young child, which of course those people don't really believe that. They're just doing it to kind of make that child feel more comfortable. And it also kind of solidifies or can solidify that gender identity in the mind of that young person, you know, and we know from studies that actually the vast majority of children with gender dysphoria will of course grow out of it. Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't be doing anything that might prevent them from growing out of it. And actually it could very clearly be argued that using names and pronouns in some situations could go, you know, could be one of the things that actually pushes them one way or the other, or encourages them one way or the other.
You said something interesting. You said the other kids don't really believe it. You said that kind of in passing. Is that, what's that based on? Yeah. Is it based on, do you have like lots of experience where that's true, or why, how, like if someone's gonna push back, like how do you know they don't believe, they don't actually agree with that?
So, I mean, so I can think of a couple of scenarios. So one is a scenario which I was told about. So I imagine it's probably a fairly common scenario. So a biological female who has had the sort of the celebration assembly where they've, you know, come out as a boy, they've been given a, you know, they've chosen a boy's name, boy's pronouns, all the children at school are using, this is kind of secondary age, so probably 13, 14, something like that. So everybody is referring to this girl as a boy, and everything all seems to be going well until this girl, the biological girl, asks another girl out on a date. And this other girl who has been calling this child by a boy's name, the reaction is, well, of course I'm not going to go out on a date with you. I'm not a lesbian. Hmm. And the girl is then absolutely devastated because she honestly thought that everyone believed she was a boy. Hmm. But of course, if they really believed she was a boy, they wouldn't be thinking that her asking them out was made them a lesbian. The other scenario is I think particularly becomes really obvious, I think perhaps more in primary schools, where often the children will accept actually and believe that the child is the gender they say they are, unless you have a child with autism. And I've come across a situation where if you've got a child who is on the autistic spectrum, another child in the class decides that, you know, to identify as the opposite sex, and this autistic child cannot handle it at all, because they, you know, they deal with facts and they know that this child was a boy and is not a girl, and no amount of anyone telling them any different, you know, and so they end up then getting into trouble because they can't change it. So yeah, those are two kind of scenarios.
Yeah. I'm curious, because I got a little echo here. Let me turn this down. If a parent comes to you and their kid wants to transition or is, you know, acting in ways that are stereotypical of the opposite sex, maybe they're wrestling with gender dysphoria and they want to be called, the child wants to be called by the pronouns that match their gender identity, for lack of better terms, even if they wouldn't frame it that way, would you, how would you counsel the parent then? Is it just case by case? I mean, it depends on what the, well, let me stop. I got all these, you know, questions that follow questions, but I'll just would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think it was interesting actually, because I was talking to somebody just yesterday who is involved in a parent support group, and they were saying that a lot of the parents, that when they first come to that group, they have started using the child's chosen name and pronouns, but actually were feeling very uncomfortable about it, weren't really that happy about it, but thought it they had no choice. And actually, once they talked to other people and kind of realised the potential implications of doing that, actually a lot of them then switch back to using the biological pronouns and their birth name. I would definitely counsel parents against using a child's chosen pronouns. I think names are a bit different. I think particularly if a child, in my experience, often they go for kind of more gender neutral names, particularly the teenagers seem to go with gender neutral names rather than clearly boys' names or girls' names. So they might go from, Luke to Luca, or, you know, some kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nickname, I suppose, because, you know, children often have nicknames, don't they? So I think that, it might be that you can have some kind of compromise and have a kind of a nickname. But I think it's just this issue of to go along with a name and pronouns which are clearly belonging to the opposite sex, is encouraging a child to take on that gender identity. And I think particularly with the issues around, restrictions now and people turning around of using things like puberty blockers and hormonal treatment, to allow a child to socially transition and then to say, but actually you're going to go through the puberty of your biological sex. Hmm. You know, potentially you are setting your child up for hugely increased distress because they've started living as the opposite sex and then they've got to go through puberty.
What happens in those situations where the parent began using the child's pronouns but then changed? Like, does that cause a lot of stress and maybe even trauma on the child? Does it sever the relationship? Or I'm sure every case is different and unique, but what's your overall perspective on how that has gone?
I think the reality is that every single one of these situations is slightly different, although there are lots of similarities. And, you know, when you hear people like Stella O'Malley and Sasha Ryad talking about their vast experience, you know, there are lots of similarities, but there are, every individual situation is an individual situation. But I think you know, I think this whole thing is so wrapped up in, you know, distress, and some of it's around, you know, normal teenage, teenagers, you know, they like to disagree with their parents, my 18-year-old son, he currently refuses to call me mum, you know, I'm Julie, and they just like to argue, they like to disagree with you, and actually conflict is kind of part of being a parent of a teenager, and we can't avoid conflict. And I think actually if we're honest with children, and I think, you know, you asked about kind of changing your mind about the pronouns. Actually, if a parent is honest and say, you know, actually we feel we've done the wrong thing here, and give reasons why, the child may not agree, as they may not agree with lots of things that we tell teenagers that they can and can't do. But it's as a parent, it's about doing what's best in the long term, isn't it? And as a medic as well, and that's where this whole controversy around puberty blockers and hormones and all the rest of it is, because it's about what's best for the child long term, not about what's going to immediately alleviate distress. Because while using their preferred pronoun name might immediately alleviate some distress, what is it going to do in the long term for that child? That is the question, isn't it?
So what? Okay, so I've got friends that work with trans teens, especially trans teens that come from pretty, not just not accepting, but sometimes some pretty hostile family environments. And I'm thinking of a couple of cases in particular where they would say like not using the trans teens, trans identified teenagers pronouns, you are like pretty massively increasing risk at suicidality, self-harm, anxiety, because this is just adding to the tremendous amount of stress that they're going through. Like, would you say that not using someone's pronouns puts the kid at higher risk of suicide?
I mean, my understanding of evidence would be that is not supported. I think that the risk of suicide is often used as a to push parents into agreeing with things. And I think, we're talking about troubled children and teenagers and difficult family situations. And I think, you know, the important thing is showing that the child is loved and understood. And I think you can show that a child is loved and understood without agreeing with them. And I think that's the key thing, is it's hearing their distress. It's showing them that you love them and you care about them. And I think, you know, I think that can be done without affirming that gender identity. I suppose like everything with teenagers, you know, and children, it's about picking your battles, isn't it? And I think that, you know, there may well be things that you can, other things you can compromise on. But I think as a parent, you have to kind of draw a line, don't you, as to where you are willing to concede or not. And I think, you know, as a parent, the things you draw the line on are the things you know are going to be harmful for your child. So, for example, you know, I'm not going to let my child live on chocolate every day, because I know it'll be harmful for them, even though they might want to. And there are all sorts of things that we as parents decide are in the best interest of our children, but we do that within a loving relationship. And I guess that's the key, isn't it? If you've already got a relationship where there's lots of conflict, then the whole pronoun thing might be an added source of conflict along with whatever else is going on.
So if there is a case where refusing to use someone's your kid's pronoun is increasing, say, anxiety, depression, suicidality, you're saying that like that might be due not to simply refusing to use their pronouns. It might be due to many other things going on in their life that you could maybe address and alleviate. But if it was a very otherwise, loving, accepting, affirming, whatever household, that if the parent doesn't use that pronoun, then that's going to be a very different case than if it is an actual very toxic kind of environment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, because it's about the environment, isn't it? You know, and, you know, I think and some of these children, you know, come from, you know, very loving families. You know, some of them come from very disturbed families, but some of them will come from very loving families, you know, and will often then, you know, they might distance themselves from their families, you know, in a way that, well, I guess teenagers do sometimes anyway, don't they? But I think, you know, the trouble with this scenario is it has such huge long-term consequences. If, you know, if a child ends up embarking down the medical surgical route, mm-hmm. that has mm-hmm. such life-changing yeah. long-term yeah. consequences that, you know, that sets it as something quite different to other kinds of scenarios. Does that make
yeah.
sense?
Yeah, totally. What would happen, like, legally or even socially if, for instance, the child comes out, let's just say they're 10 years old, they change their name, their pronouns, they have a celebration party at school, and what if word gets back that their parent is basically the only one who's not accepting this new name change and pronoun, or let's just say the pronoun change. Could the parent lose custody of the child? Or what would happen even just socially if people were aware that the parent refuses to do what everybody else is doing and celebrating?
I mean, I think that's what everyone worries about, isn't it? You know, that kind of, and I think there have been kind of reports of scenarios where parents have lost custody of their children. I mean, I think it would be probably as part of a bigger scenario. I would have thought. I mean, you know, in my professional kind of capacity, you know, I come across more people who are concerned that parents are going along with their child's gender identity mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. concerned that parents aren't going along with it. That's what I've encountered professionally. Okay. I mean, I guess it depends where you work and you know what country you're in even. But I think because there is increasing concern now about the use of puberty blockers and hormones, and then I think it is changing people's opinion as well, because I think people are realizing that it's not as simple as this child is trans, they need to socially transition, they need to go on puberty blockers, they need cross-sex hormones, mm-hmm. you know, everything sorted, job done, because it's not that simple. And actually, you know, there is increasing evidence that, you know, it's not the best way to treat children, and so I think that does therefore change the perspective, I think, on social transition.
Can we back up? And I want to talk about that now, like the kind of change in perspective. And we talked offline just briefly, but from my vantage point, you know, the United States and Canada are still very, very much like the gender affirmative only approach to treating trans identified kids and teenagers is, you know, almost every professional organization embraces that. Any other approach is viewed as conversion therapy, and some people are even trying to outlaw it, you know. In fact, we have this SOGI laws, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity change efforts are viewed as, you know, dehumanizing, if not, you know, destructive. But it seems like, from my vantage point, in the UK and in Europe, Sweden and other countries that have already kind of gone down the gender affirmative only route have kind of, in the last year or two, began to rethink that. And from a secular perspective, this isn't just Christian, you know, this is people saying, I don't think, like you just said, it seems like it's more complicated than this for the long-term health of this child. Maybe the gender affirmative only approach isn't the best. Is that an accurate, I mean, you're in the UK, so I mean, is that an accurate read on the situation, or what's been the last 5 years of medical discussion regarding gender identity among kids in the UK?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. The scene is kind of changing. You know, when I first started kind of looking into this and sort of writing a few bits about it, there were a few of us raising concerns, and kind of people were a bit kind of, you know, interestingly, in my workplace, I did a teaching session about 3 years ago now on treatment of children with gender dysphoria. And my colleagues were horrified that children were receiving puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. People didn't even know it was happening, which is really interesting. And as people have realised what's happening, they're kind of people are becoming more uncomfortable about it. But I mean, I think the Kira Bell case obviously was a key kind of issue where, you know, the UK courts ruled that the children were not able to give informed consent for this kind of experimental treatment that has such long-term consequences, particularly on fertility and sexual function, which, of course, a pre-pubertal child can't give consent about something that they have no experience of and no knowledge of.
Real quick, for the audience that doesn't know, can you explain just briefly the Kira Bell case?
So Kira Bell was or is a young lady who went through transition. And I'm not exactly sure how much of a transition she went through, but she basically transitioned, was living as a man. She'd had hormones, certainly, and I think probably a mastectomy, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. And she then, obviously, she's now what we call a detransitioner. So she's now living as a woman again, and it is very clear that she shouldn't have been put down that route of medical treatment, and that her underlying issues should have been dealt with rather than people just kind of going along with this idea that transitioning was the answer to all her problems. Because that's what you see in these children and these teenagers. They think that transitioning is going to miraculously sort out all their problems. And instead of the psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists actually dealing with whatever issues they might have as well as the gender issues, they just, you know, push them straight down the affirmative only route. So as a result of the Kira Bell case, and also as a result of a number of clinicians at the gender identity clinic raising concerns, which was all around the same kind of time. So there is underway a review. The NHS England are reviewing the treatment of children and reviewing the use of puberty blockers. There was recently a NICE, which is National Institute for Clinical Excellence, who kind of deal with all the treatments and things in the NHS. They did a review of the evidence of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and concluded the evidence is really, really poor. And that, you know, the evidence just is not there to use these treatments on children at all.
I'm curious about, you've mentioned several times now, you know, these are troubled teens. Maybe can you explain that a little more? I mean, a trans-identified teenager, are they troubled because they are trans and society doesn't accept them, or they're being, you know, there's social kind of pressure on them or whatever, or are there other mental health issues going on? Or what do you mean by troubled teens?
Oh, that's a tricky question, you know. And obviously, I'm not a therapist, and I, you know, or a psychologist. I'm just a humble pediatrician, but I think, I mean, I suppose, you know, growing up is tricky for lots of children. Puberty is a difficult time for everybody, and we're in a kind of generation as well where mental health is a big issue amongst teenagers. Generally, and you know, we're all very aware that, you know, teenagers have kind of poor mental health, you know, and there's lots of concerns about it. And I think, my experience that, you know, the children that I've seen, you know, have all had other issues going on. Now, which came first, or which, you know, is really for an experienced therapist to unpick, rather than just kind of saying, oh, gender, let's go with that. And I think that is the big issue. Okay. You know, so you might have a child, for example, who has been abused. So that might be one of the issues. You might have a child who's had a difficult relationship with, you know, with a parent or with a sibling. You might have a child who, you know, just finds puberty difficult, went through puberty early and has found that really difficult transition. Of course, a lot of there is also a big association with autism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a big number of the children who, or teenagers who identify as transgender actually are on the autistic spectrum. Now, you know, I don't think anybody totally understands what the relationship is, but there might be any number of reasons why that's the case.
I've heard that several in several places, and I mean, you're more of an expert in autism. So when you said that, I was like, oh, I wrote down in my notepad here. I'm like, I want to ask about that because I've seen percentages anywhere. I mean, I don't know. It, probably a general one is, you know, 25% of teenagers who identify as trans are on the autism spectrum. I've seen 10%. I've seen, so somewhere in that range, whereas 2% of the general population, according to Google, I mean, I Googled around a couple of places, about 2% might be on the spectrum. So that's, you know, 5-10 times, I did my math right, 5 or 10 times higher. What, yeah. Do you have any thoughts on why a fairly high percentage of trans-identified teens are on the spectrum? I mean, is there a organic connection there, or is it just, I don't know?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, you quoted some statistics there, and I'm pretty sure that the Tavistock, the Gender Identity Clinic in London, has actually said, I think it's somewhere like near 40% of their referrals have got autistic features. Okay. So they may not have a diagnosis of autism, but they have autistic features. Well, I think, I mean, my understanding from, you know, some of the amazingly, you know, experienced therapists that I've spoken to is that I think there's all sorts of reasons. So when children are on the autistic spectrum, they struggle with social relationships. They struggle with friendships, and which can make them feel like a bit of a misfit, a bit of an odd one out. And if they then kind of get, you know, in with a group that kind of tells them that they're trans, that the reason they don't fit in is because they're transgender, they, you know, could easily accept that. I think the other thing is that children on the autistic spectrum often get very fixated by things, and they're very black and white about things. So once they fixate onto an idea, then it's very difficult to get them off it. So if they, for whatever reason, begin to believe that they're the opposite sex, then it's very hard for them to change that view again. And I think there's also can be sensory issues. So children on the autistic spectrum often are very kind of have lots of sensory issues. So they might really like sparkly things or soft things, or they might not like certain types of clothes. So the kind of thing about boy-girl clothes might be partly a sensory driven thing. So I think there's all sorts of potential reasons or contributing factors as to why they kind of, you know, head down this line, you know, or they're just, you know, sometimes I think they also are very prone to being influenced online as well, because, you know, when you're on the autistic spectrum, they often struggle with face-to-face social relationships, so they might conduct a lot of their relationships online. And if they find a community of kind of, you know, gender variant people online, then they can easily get, you know, join that community and identify with them.
Would you, if you were like, if you were approaching a trans identified teen on the autism spectrum and another one that's not on the autism spectrum, would you approach those differently in a sense? Like, is there a, If you're trying to like work through the dysphoria, how can we address the dysphoria, you know, from a maybe psychological perspective? Does that look categorically different between an autistic kid and a non-autistic kid, or?
I mean, well, as I say, I'm not a therapist, so not particularly kind of, but I mean, my experience is often it's the other, it's kind of the flip, the other way around, is that the children present with gender dysphoria, and the question then is often, actually, are they on the autistic spectrum?
Okay.
Here's what I thought.
Or do they have ADHD? Or so rather than necessarily they come to you with autism and then your gender, it's often the other way around. Because I think if you already know they've got autism, that is probably easier to kind of manage, because you know what you're dealing with. And there are very specific So things like CBT and that kind of thing have to be done in a very specific way, I understand, when you've got children on the autistic spectrum. Okay. But more often it's undiagnosed. So particularly with the girls, because autism is often undiagnosed or diagnosed much later in girls. So it can be that the gender issues are the things that, and the mental health problems around that are the first thing that pop up, and then you discover actually they're on the autistic spectrum.
I'm curious. So as a pediatrician, I'll stop asking you therapy questions. Let's stick to your actual field. I mean, as a pediatrician, are you seeing I don't want to say a percentage because I don't know, but like a percentage of teenagers or kids that did identify as trans and now no longer are, even if it was just kind of a social transition, maybe they went through a certain phase or whatever. I know people don't like that phrase, but I mean, are you seeing that more and more? Or are you seeing kids that once they identify as trans, that they keep identifying as trans?
That's a difficult one to answer, because they, as a pediatrician, we don't actually see that many of them, because they would normally be referred to the child and adolescent mental health services rather than to us.
Okay.
So we wouldn't necessarily see them unless we were seeing them probably for another reason. And also, of course, as a paediatrician, I would only be seeing children up to the age of kind of 16 or 17.
Okay.
And often it seems that because of the way things are at the moment, that they socially transition and, you know, up until recently have been able to then go on puberty blockers and then cross sex hormones. It's often the kind of young adults that are the ones that seem to be detransitioning. So okay. They would be out of our remit, as it were. And I think that's one of the issues as well, is the whole follow-up issue, is that nobody really knows what happens to these kids. Because, you know, they might be afraid to tell people that they've detransitioned. They might not come back for help. They might be, you know, ashamed to. So I don't think anybody really knows what happens to these children.
It seems like, again, anecdotally, that there's a growing number of detransitioners. And I know that, like you said, it's getting an actual percentage is complicated for various reasons. Kids not returning back, or, you know, studies being skewed or having bad methodology. But are you, just anecdotally, just as a person in the gender conversation in the UK, does it seem like there's a growing number of detransitioners? Or how do you think through that?
Well, there's certainly a growing number of detransitioners coming forward. There's a growing community of detransitioners, and I guess if you look at so you know, for example, the numbers of referrals to the gender identity clinic in the UK kind of had this massive spike over the last kind of few. I mean, it's kind of leveled out now, but there was a massive spike. So I guess the detransitioners from that will be in the next few years. So we probably haven't necessarily seen those coming through, you know, and the sort of, you know, the numbers that I'm, you know, hearing about sort of kids transitioning in schools and things like that, you know, a lot of those kids haven't even been seen in a gender clinic yet. You know, they're still on a waiting list, you know, they socially transition often before they've even seen a medical professional, which goes back to the whole pronoun thing, is that people are embarking on this social transition thing, and these kids haven't even seen a health professional a lot of the time. This is just being done on their say so, which is a concern.
How do you explain? Somebody asked me this. Actually, a couple of people asked me this question, and it's always a tough one to answer. People say, okay, like it seems like within the medical community, there's a growing diversity of medical professionals thinking through how to address, you know, a child or a teen with gender dysphoria or identifying as trans. And yet in the school system, it just seems like there's no diversity. It seems to be, for lack of better terms, a very just radical progressive view that's not even liberal. I mean, maybe I shouldn't use that term. I know UK liberal is different than American liberal, but I know a lot of very liberal people who would be concerned about some of the just radicalness of the teaching on gender in public schools. And it sounds mm-hmm. Like you said, they have celebration parties and everything, but then in the medical community, there's a lot of more diverse opinions on this. And I don't have the answer. Like, how do you explain that dichotomy? Is it just how did a certain viewpoint become so pervasive in the school system? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's one of the biggest issues. It is exactly what you've just described. And, you know, and I think it's partly because there has been a very active sort of groups of people who've gone into schools and trained schools and trained other professions as well in this whole gender ideology thing. A lot of, education professionals, for example, they don't know any different, and if they have been told by the experts that you've got to affirm this child, you've got to use their pronouns, you've got to do all of this, otherwise they're going to commit suicide, which, as I said, that is not true. The statistics don't bear that out. And so they've been told that that's what they have to do. And, I've spoken to a number of education professionals, actually, who have been very uncomfortable about doing this, but have done it because they felt that that was what they had to do and that was, what they were being told. There's this sort of huge capture of kind of, well, all the institutions by these kind of, activist organizations that are sort of pushing one agenda rather than making sure that everyone's got all of the information and the right information and facts and evidence, and that's what's really lacking, I think, in this whole argument. I think that's probably where the medical professionals perhaps are a bit different, is that perhaps we have a bit more access to the to the evidence and the arguments. And certainly in the UK, it's the secular medical professionals and therapists, etc., who are making the biggest noise about this.
Really?
Not the Christians, sadly.
I think I remember reading somewhere that, like, I think it was about a year ago, maybe, that there was some statement signed by the Royal College of General Practitioners in the UK about. Yep. Signing some, maybe was that about concern over puberty blockers, or I'm not recalling it. Does that ring a bell at all? Or
I mean, there's the memorandum of understanding, which is about conversion therapy, which kind of lots of organisations signed up to, but I think maybe the Royal College of General Practice didn't sign up to it.
Maybe that's not what I'm thinking of. I know there's some medical professors at Oxford. Michael Biggs, I think, is one of them.
Yeah.
And
Carl Hennehan.
These are hype. These are like top of the top, right? And they've raised concerns.
Yeah.
What is their concerns? They're not like ethically against transitioning on an absolute level, I don't think, but just are they concerned over like teenagers being rushed to transition? Or
it is this whole concern about the impact of puberty blockers. So I think when puberty blockers were first kind of started to be used in this scenario, they were used under the kind of understanding that what it would do would be alleviate the distress of the child of going through puberty in order for them to undergo therapy and to be able to kind of, work out what was going on and kind of, and then that the puberty blockers could be reversed and then they could go through puberty, if they change their mind. And unfortunately, and I suppose it doesn't take much to kind of work out why, but what they actually found out was that once these children went onto puberty blockers, almost all of them, I think it's 99% of them or something like that, go on to have cross-sex hormones. And, and of course, logically, if you kind of think about it, you realise that for a lot of children with gender dysphoria, it's kind of the process of puberty that matures their body and their mind and enables them to then come to terms with their body. They might, you know, feel quite uncomfortable with it while it's going on, and, you know, and being a teenager is you know, it's time of trying to understand who you are. But of course, if you pause that, if you halt puberty, you stop them doing all that stuff. So it's not just the physical changes you stop. It's the brain changes. It's the emotional changes. All of those things that would help them come to terms with their biological sex, or potentially, in the majority of cases, you've stopped it. Mm-hmm. So they then get stuck in that kind of immature, you know, childlike phase. And then the next logical thing is the cross-sex hormone. So, yeah, so you know, Michael Biggin and Carl Hennehan, you know, they raised all the concerns about this and about the poor evidence, and also the evidence of the, you know, the long-term effects of puberty blockers. Because obviously when you go through puberty, you have a growth spurt, your bone density changes, all of those things. So if you stop that, you know, you stop all of those normal physical changes, as well as all the brain changes and emotional changes.
I've had two endocrinologists on in the last several months. Paul Ruse, do you know Paul Ruse? He's an American endocrinologist. No. Michael Laidlaw. Do you know Michael?
I've heard of him. Yeah. I've not met him.
He's friends with Will Malone. I know you know Will. And they both said almost the exact same things. And not even like, well, here's my thoughts, but there's other perspectives. It's kind of like, there's some basic endocrinology. Here's from an endocrinologist perspective, here's what the risks you run if you do either puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones. And it my understanding, again, I don't like getting over my skis, as we say, you know, and speaking beyond what I know. From what I understand, we just don't know the long-term effects of puberty blockers. We know that there are risks, all the things that you mentioned, but then in terms like, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, we just don't know, because this has been such a new, quote unquote, experimental way of treating gender dysphoria. But we do know some of the side effects and concerns with cross-sex hormones, right? We do have a lot more knowledge and studies of the risks that people run taking cross-sex hormones. Would that be correct? Or
yeah, I mean, I obviously, you know, someone like Will or Michael Laidlaw would be much better placed to answer this. But yes, I mean, so we do have, but what we know is the effects of those, mostly in older people. So obviously, that, you know, there have been adults who've taken cross-sex hormones and had sex, you know, sex change surgery and all that kind of thing. So we do know some of the long-term effects of that. But younger people and teenagers being given cross-sex hormones is still a very new phenomenon. Still don't really know, because that is a very new, you know, much newer phenomenon. So that is still, I would guess, quite an unknown thing. Yeah. But yes, we do know much of the effects.
Do you think, going back to the kind of public school view of things, and then the medical professional having more diversity of thought and rethinking some things, do you see, if you can make a prediction, I don't know if you have the prophetic gift or not, that the school system will end up catching up to some of the current medical perspective? In 2 or 3 or 4 years, do you think there will be more diversity of thought within the schools, or does it not look too hopeful?
Well, there are certainly a lot of people in the UK working very hard to try and kind of change what's happening in schools. In the UK, there was a new guidance around relationships and sex education came out last year. And as part of that, there was a bit in it which talked about about gender ideology and making sure that facts are taught and that children aren't taught that just because you like girl things that you're a girl, or just because you like boy things that you're a boy kind of thing. And so there are a number of secular organisations who are working very hard to kind of try and counter and argue and make sure that, you know, that actually what children are being taught in school is accurate, scientific, and also complies with the Equality Act as well. So there is a lot going on, a lot going on.
And can you talk to us just briefly about what's going on in, I think, Sweden? I think I got it from your Twitter feed, actually, that did they outlaw puberty blockers for kids under 18? Did I read that right? Or?
Yeah. So I mean, I haven't read it in masses of detail today. I've been too busy, but so it seems that in Sweden, the clinic there, which I think is the main clinic which treats children there, has made a ruling that because of the concerns around use of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, that they are not going to use them in under 16-year-olds at all, and in 16 to 18-year-olds only as part of a clinical trial. So that's what they, come up with in Sweden. So, which is really encouraging, together with the sort of, developments that have happened in the UK over the last year. It looks like things might be turning. And of course, the key thing then is making sure that these children get the help that they need. It's no use just saying, well, you can't have that.
Right.
We need to then make sure that they are getting the therapeutic help, the psychological help that they actually need. And that is the key. That's the key thing that we need to be making sure now.
And I know that, again, so this isn't your primary area, but when kids do get the proper help, or I mean, when certain possible psychological issues are addressed first rather than, transitioning to them, have you seen from your perspective success in that? Because I have heard people say, like, well, I've heard people tell me, the only way we know that is effective in treating gender dysphoria is medical transitioning. And there's obviously different opinions on that. Have you seen, when people do approach it from a more psychological perspective, that there is success in reducing dysphoria? Because I've got friends that they were like, I've got one friend in particular, who after several years of trying to address the dysphoria through, other ways, suicide, two suicide attempts, and just nothing was working, and that's, I don't really have a, it's not my area, but I'm like, I don't know what I would say. What do you do when a psychological approach just isn't working, for lack of better terms? I mean, you just keep going, or how do you?
I think it's really difficult, isn't it? And I think it is one of those things where there are no easy answers. And I suppose it's the same with, mental health generally, isn't it? There are people who suffer with depression for their entire lives. There are people who suffer with anxiety for their entire lives. And it doesn't matter what treatment you give them, sometimes they will always struggle with it. And I think there are people who will struggle with gender dysphoria their entire lives. But there are equally, I suppose probably the most helpful thing is hearing stories of adults who now look back at their childhood and say, goodness, if I'd grown up in this kind of scenario now, I think I would have identified as transgender. So I think Stella O'Malley says that, and I've heard, a number of others kind of saying that, they're, when they were a child, they really wanted to be a boy. They thought they were a boy. But actually, back in those days, you were a tomboy, or, a sort of girl who just liked climbing trees and whatever it was. But then they've gone through puberty and got married and had children and, been perfectly happy to be a woman. So I guess perhaps that is, perhaps that's where we kind of need to look at those ones, because those are the ones who their gender dysphoria was there. It was real, but it resolved. But actually they're, those people are quite clear that, they think that if they were growing up in today's society, they would probably have identified as transgender, and maybe may have gone down the, medical and surgical route and been infertile and had to have medical treatment for the rest of their lives.
Which is, that is so sad, like you said, that's where a big concern of mine is specifically with teens and children being raised in the environment we have today. Maybe they're dysphoria is wrapped up with other things that need to be addressed, you know? I mean, the whole rapid onset gender dysphoria discussion, and it's just, and it's troubling when, in particular, in schools, you know, I talked to a lot of friends that are in the public school system, and how there's no diversity of thought. There's nothing. It's like there's the gender affirmative only approach, and then everything else is transphobic or conversion therapy. And it's like, man, it's still is shocking, because there's from my perspective, there's a good number of very secular, very liberal voices who are saying, no, there's several different ways in which we're still learning, you know, to approach someone who identifies as trans. There just simply is no one size fits all. Well, Julie, I've taken enough of your time, and I really appreciate you reaching out. The pronoun thing, I know it's really sensitive, really touchy, especially when it involves parents and kids. And so I really hope that parents maybe listening can take away just, man, this can be really complicated, you know? But I hope that your perspective will give them something to think about. Do you have any final words for specifically a parent with a child or teenager who's identifying as trans? And it's, you know, my audience is primarily going to be Christian parents. Any last words of advice for that parent?
I guess I would say, you know, walk with them, love them, pray for them. And, you know, whatever the sort of outcome, kind of keep your line and know that you've done what you can in the most loving way that you can. I suppose that, because you don't want to kind of in the future regret saying things or doing things, but loving them sometimes is about being truthful and biblical, not just going with what they say.
It's a good word. Julie, thank you so much. Really appreciate you. Thanks for coming on Theology in the Rough.